Hey, I'm Aaron Comas.
And I'm Chris Barron, and we're Spin Doctors.
And you're listening to Life Minute TV.
It's been 12 years since legendary rock, funk, blues, alt-rocker Spin Doctors dropped a new album, their first with Capitol Records, and a brand new bassist. Yep, this pivotal four-piece band is back in a big way with Face Full of Cake, full of fun hooks and the funky sound they're known and loved for. Formed in 88 in New York City, they burst into the mainstream with their full-length 91 debut, Pocket Full of Kryptonite, selling more than 10 million copies worldwide, with several massive singles that are ubiquitous to this day. Singer-songwriter Chris Barron and drummer Aaron Comas came by the Life Minute Studios to tell us all about it, plus their upcoming summer tour with Blues Traveler and Jim Blossoms. This is a Life Minute with the Spin Doctors.
Spin Doctors in the house.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us on Life Minute. So happy to have you guys.
Thanks for having us. This is so fun.
We're having a ball already. We had fun before we started.
Yeah. What did the young people say? We were like dishing tea in the, or whatever.
Got all those good cookies that we didn't
spilling tea. All right, Face Full of Cake. Gosh, your first album in 12 years, is it?
Yep.
Wow. What took so long?
Yeah, Aaron, what took so long? Why did we
even like
do
to
it?
Take our time, you know? We've just been busy playing a lot of concerts, and it just took a while to sort of get us all together in a room writing together again. You know, I think if you look at historically through our career, we're a very prolific band, but we have little periods where we end up getting together, writing a lot of songs together. Like in the beginning of the band, it was just, you know, when we were forming and getting all our stuff together, we probably had like 50 songs, mm-hmm. you know, the first couple years. And then like the best of those sort of went on the record, first couple records. And it's just been, we've been busy, you know, but we did get together like right around the pandemic. I think that was sort of the thing that got us inspired. You know, once things sort of cleared up a little bit and it was okay to get back together, we started doing some writing sessions. We, you know, split up in different groups. Eric and Chris got together. Me and Chris got together. The three of us got together.
And then I got together with myself alone.
He got together with himself, you know. And we ended up with just a bunch of really good songs. So we decided to go in the studio. Jack Daly, who's our new bass player, has a great studio in Asbury Park. And the idea was just to go record some demos, just to get them down and see what we got. And because of that, it was just a really relaxed environment, and it just went great. And a couple of days into it, we were like, wow, you know, this sounds amazing. I think this is it. I think we're making our record here. And that was it. A couple of weeks later, we had a record.
It is great. It sounds awesome.
Thank you.
It sounds like you guys, but maybe heavier, or, you know?
Yeah.
It's excellent. It's
cool.
Very good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I hope your viewers will check it out. Listen, if you check out our record and you don't like it, you come and find Aaron, and he will give you your money back.
I'll give you the $9.99 you pay a month to Apple or whatever.
We'll pay you that month's subscription.
We'll give you the little percentage of that nine. That
What would you say you feel inspired you on this one?
I mean, for me, you know, after lockdown, one of the big things for me was, you know, we've been working together for 35 years, and we've never taken each other for granted or anything like that. But when somebody is that ubiquitous in your life, you just kind of tend to, I guess, take them for granted a little bit, you know? And during lockdown, you know, we were like texting each other all the time. We have a text thread, and we're like putting our dinner in the text thread and stuff like that. And it just was like, after not seeing, you know, I hadn't gone, you know, 18 months without seeing these guys in forever, you know? And so for me, it was like, we got out of lockdown and it was like, you know, let's make a record, let's get together, let's do some writing. Like, life is short, you never know like what's gonna happen. It was one of the big revelations for me. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah, definitely.
How does it work for you guys creatively? Like, what's the process like? Do you write the lyrics first, or?
As a songwriter, I'm really lucky. 'Cause like, you know, on this particular album, I wrote, you know, just me, I wrote the music and lyrics for like four or five of the songs. And then Aaron and I wrote, Aaron composed the music and I wrote the lyrics. I write the lyrics, right, basically. And so Eric wrote the music on some, you know, like several of the songs too. So I'm really lucky because I can sit down and I can write a song and hand it off to these guys, and they'll like take my song and turn it into like a killer Spin Doctors song, or I can just sit around and write lyrics and not worry about music at all and know that Aaron is a brilliant composer, and I'm sure a lot of your favorite songs Aaron composed the music to. And so I can, you know, we get together and I'm just like, he'd play me something and I'll be like, oh, I think I got something for that. And I'll like put lyrics to it and a melody. And same with Eric, you know. It's a little different with Aaron and Eric. When I get together with Aaron, Aaron's like musical pieces are often characterized by really odd time signatures and rhythmically. So he sort of has to teach me the music of it, because a lot of times I'm like, wait, where does it start? And Aaron has to kind of like show me like how it all works. And then I'm kind of like finding my way through it. Whereas Eric is just like, what do you got? And I'm like, how about this? And I just start singing and Eric will instantaneously be able to accompany what I'm doing and just come up with music for it like on the spot. So it's...
But it's cool. I think one of the things that makes our records diverse, there's a different styles of music that all make the Spin Doctors, and that's because of what Chris just said, because everybody contributes a certain amount, and if it was all Chris's songs, that'd be great, but it'd be, you know, it's just there's more different types of styles that are thrown into the pot, and I really appreciate it. I mean, I'm the drummer of the band, you know, so it's like usually drummers don't get to write songs, and but I play guitar and write music, so I really appreciate that Chris has been, you know, really into collaborating with me. And Eric too, as the guitar player, it took for me to hand off something I wrote on guitar to him. And me and Eric also get together and do stuff and then bring it in. It's just all those combinations, you know. And over the years, sometimes we'll just write songs on, a lot of our songs, especially in the early days, were just written on stage. Because we jam out and improvise a lot on stage. And particularly in the old days, we would play like, you know, 4-hour shows. We'd do like 3 sets. So sometimes the 3rd set, we would just be up there messing around. And like a lot of songs got written that way.
Wow,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, like
yeah.
On our first record, the song, What Time Is It, just spontaneously came together. Yeah. And I actually said like, you know, it was like, it was 4:30 in the, what time is it? 4:30, it's not late, it's early. And it was 4:30 in the morning. And I like turned to our friend Darren Green and was like, what time is it? And he was like 4:30. And then Eric just started playing this thing. And I was like, what time is it? 4:30, it's not late, it's early. And that's like, that's how that song came together, is just like spontaneously.
Yeah, I mean, Chris has always had an amazing ability to just improvise lyrics on the spot, so we were able to do that. And same thing with the writing, like sometimes I know stuff we've written, I mean, sometimes, usually I come in with a pretty complete piece of music, you know, and Chris, there's been a lot of times where he'd just come up with lyrics right there. He might ask me, were you thinking about anything when you wrote this? But a lot of times, or sometimes he'll go into his book and find something he's already written that fits, you know. But I mean, he has an amazing ability to just write right on the spot. And almost every time we've gotten together, when the time was right, there's certainly been periods where the vibe just wasn't there, you know. But like this last period, and a lot of different periods over the years, I mean, we always come out with a song, you know. Only a few times has it been like, all right, well, you know. We always come out with a completed song, you know. So, and I figured out this time to get him over, I just have to offer to make him dinner after.
One of the big sessions that we did where we wrote "Still a Gorilla" from this new record and "Holding the Moon Over Me," like, I'm sort of lazy, you know. So Aaron was like, "All right, let's get together and write." And I was like, "Cool. What do you want to do?" He was like, "What do you want to do?" I was like, "Why don't you come over to my house?" And he was like, "Okay, great," because Aaron's super easygoing and probably the coolest guy in the band. And like the night before or that morning? That morning, yeah. I call Aaron and I was like, hey, how about I come over to your house and we write, and then Lindsay will come over later, my wife, and you guys can make us dinner. And he was like, sure, man. And so we just went over, we wrote a couple of songs. Yeah. Lindsay showed up around 6. We like had a martini. And
3 hours later, 3 hours later, we had 2 songs and we were eating. Yeah,
what did you make?
What did I make that?
You
night?
Made a killer steak. Yeah, you made a steak, and you made like a tuna tartare like avocado in it. It was like gorgeous. And then we had like martinis and a great bottle of wine. And then I took.
So that's how
some
I do
scotch.
It now. Then like about a month later, I was like, hey, come on over.
Come on over. I'll make you dinner.
It's like the reward, you know. You write a good song, you get a dinner.
But I think if I was watching the show right now, I'd be like, okay, Spin Doctors, this guy's been around forever. Bands like their early stuff is always the best stuff. You know, why should I check out this record? You know, it's probably just gonna be some like rehashed, like whatever stuff. It's gonna be like Two Princes. And I think this band we have been committed always to getting better as musicians and getting better as writers. One of the reasons that that happens, you continuously hear people saying like, oh, I like the early stuff, but they don't like the later stuff as much, is I think that when you're early, especially if you have a little success, you start to try and like repeat that success. And the trick is sort of understanding what's good about your style and your personality as a writer and keeping that in there, but also continually honing your skills. And as a lyricist, like I'm always reading the best. I'm reading like Shakespeare and I'm reading, you know, T.S. Eliot and all this like crazy stuff and trying to like stay fresh and try and keep these good like writing ideas. I'm not gonna write like a lyric that's like a copy of T.S. Eliot, but you know, we've tried really hard. Aaron's always practicing the drums. He's always like working on new ideas musically. So, you know, you don't want to like go into like the Spinal Tap, like Jazz Odyssey thing. You know, you don't want to go off that rail, and you don't want to keep trying to do the same thing that pleased people 30 years ago when you were young. You want to kind of, you know, hone in and pursue your personality and the things that were good about what you did, but not like to do the same trick over and over again. So.
Yeah, I mean, we've always had our best results when you don't think about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think really that's the trick to most art is like, just be yourself, you know? Anytime you're trying to sort of repeat something you did or trying to be like somebody else that you think is popular, I mean, it's always a mistake. I mean, when we came out, you know, at the time, it's not like we were reinventing the wheel, but there wasn't a lot of stuff that really sounded like us. And, you know, the record company didn't really know what to do with us. You know, they were like, you guys need some tattoos. You have no image, you know, and you have no singles. And we had something unique just by being ourselves, you know, and that's really the same thing now. You know, don't think about it, just do what you do. And I think we were able to really do that on this record. You know, we really were. And it feels really good. And it's really helped our live show. It's nice to have a bunch of new material to play live. It goes over really well. And, you know, it's not like we're slamming it down our throats. I mean, people come out and see us, they're going to hear everything they want to hear. But you sort of figure out what songs really work. And to me, you know, like at this point in our career, and especially as a band that plays so many live shows, to me, like the mark of a successful song or a successful record is if two or three songs, like if we're sitting here in 3 years and two or three songs from this record, we're still playing live, that to me, that's like success. And there's like a couple songs, like when we go back to all our other records, like Nice Talking to Me, you know, there's a couple songs from that, like Margarita and Nice Talking to Me and Sugar, you know, that stand out. But you know, you have to think about the people that come to see you too, you know, and not be self-indulgent.
Yeah, and if you come and see a Spin Doctor show, we're gonna play Little Miss Can't Be Wrong. We're gonna play Two Princes. Like we always play the hits. I mean, I did a solo show like years ago and I didn't play Two Princes. And somebody came up to me afterwards and they were like, I drove 10 hours to hear that song. And I was like, okay, cool. You know what? Just gonna do that. Like, and I mean, we like playing those songs too.
Yeah,
we're not like, you have to play the hit again. People always say, do you get tired of playing the hits? And we're like, sorry, do I get tired of playing a song I wrote and watching people go nuts? Like, no, don't get tired of that.
Yeah, you want to get a reaction out of an audience, you know?
Yeah.
And, so we're lucky to have those songs. They've kept us going all these years. And we're lucky to have this new record. I mean, like a song like Gorilla, it's one of the songs off the new record that, I mean, we've been playing it live for a couple of years now before we put it out. And it just slays every night, you know? So to have something like that that's new and you just see to have it just work so well, it's like a gift, you know?
Yeah, and it's a pop, to go back to like what we were talking about earlier, it's an opportunity, like you said, like this new record, you know, that you seem to like it and you were like, maybe a little bit heavier. And like, I think probably Still a Gorilla is one of the songs that like made you have that reaction. And it's, you have this opportunity and you can see it in the audiences, that, you know, when we play, it's like we're playing, people know like Two Princes, and they, you know, Little Miss Can't Be Wrong, but then they're like, oh man, these guys play some like really hard, like funky stuff. And then they're like, what about this song? I never heard this song before. And then you pop it into like a heavy song, like Still a Gorilla, and you get this opportunity to kind of triangulate what you're doing. And people can see the connection of this like heavy song to the poppy stuff and how it's the same band and how all these things kind of come together. And basically, you know, I think one of the great things about this band and one of the things I'd like to sort of expand on is that we're known for these two very poppy songs, but we really, I mean, honestly, like, I think we have like a huge trove of absolutely unbelievable material. People think they're going to come out and see a Spin Doctor show and they're just going to like hang out for these two songs, but we don't have any bad songs. We don't play bad songs. We're, you know, the band is, and if you come out to a show and you don't think our songs are any good, just find Aaron and he'll give you your money back. No, I'll give you your money back.
Excellent, so good. But your tour with Gin Blossoms and Blues Traveler, yep. Yes. You used to be in Blues Traveler.
Was in an early incarnation of Blues Traveler before it was called Blues Traveler, yes. John Popper and I went to high school together. And let me tell you, that guy played like that in high school. Wow. It was amazing going to high school, being like, you know, 15 years old, he was 16, and actually meeting somebody and knowing somebody who you absolutely knew for certain was going to be extremely famous. It was really cool, and it kind of like, for me as a guy who was like, maybe I'll join the Navy, or I mean, like, sort of like, didn't know how I was gonna like get through life. Nothing wrong with joining the Navy, but I was, you know, at all, you know what I mean? I was just sort of like, how can I like actually like support myself somehow? Because I did really badly in school, you know. But knowing a guy like John, it kind of busted the horizons of what you thought was possible for a person that you knew or yourself to do, you know. So it's going to be really fun being out with those guys, because I went to high school with all those guys, and we're just going to be like trooping around on buses.
And we've toured a lot with both of them. We've done a lot of touring with Jim Blossoms, a lot of touring with Blues Traveler. You know, as Chris said, he grew up with them, and we both come from New York City. So
we've known the Jim Blossoms for over 30 years now, too. So, you know, it's going to be great. Three bands of like old buddies out on the road, throwing down. We'll definitely be sitting in on each other's sets, and there'll be like guest appearances. And
we just went out to Rob in the Center for Jim Blossom's studio yesterday and did like a collaboration. We did a song together. We're gonna, you know, so that'll be like out on Instagram probably. But there's gonna be a lot of good times. It's gonna be fun, and I think the people who come out are gonna really enjoy it.
And some of the shows are sold out too.
It's selling well. So like, get your tickets.
Go get your tickets. Atlantic City is like pretty close to being sold out, and a number of the dates are sold out. So like, jump, put your phone down,
or pick up your phone,
or pick up your phone and buy a ticket.
right.
You
can put it down and go on the computer and buy a ticket.
Yeah, put like this phone down. Put this phone down. Right. Put this phone up.
Awesome. And where else are you going to be hitting? A couple big festivals too.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, we're doing a bunch of them. We just did Boston Calling last weekend, which was great. We're doing Bourbon and Beyond. We're doing, what's the other one we're doing? Yeah, Ocean's Calling.
Ocean's Calling. Yes, Ocean's Calling.
And then we have a bunch of our own headlining shows outside of this. We're doing a 4-night stint in Park City at this really cool theater. So we're going to do like, we're going to play the whole new record, Faceful of Cake, in its entirety one night with other songs. We're going to do Pocketful of Kryptonite in its entirety. And then we're going to do two like regular shows. So it's going to be four totally different shows.
Awesome. Why that title, Faceful of Cake?
Well, you know, it's funny. Every record we've ever made, for the most part, we've always had a title, a working title, and then it changes. And we end up with like 10 titles. Yeah, that's it now, maybe then. So this one originally, right after we recorded, we were gonna call it Rock and Roll Heaven. That was like the working title for the longest time. And then we just decided to call it Boombox. But then we realized there's like a million records called Boombox. And then we were gonna call it Gorilla. And then we weren't sure about that. And then I called Chris. I said, do me a favor, send me all the lyrics. I just wanted to read through the lyrics. Because sometimes record titles, it's like a line in a song. Like Pocketful of Kryptonite is a line of a song. Or I always thought Jagged Little Pill by Alanis Morissette was a really great title. And I'll never forget the first time I never knew why it was called that. And then when she put out that single, I remember hearing it on the radio when she said the line Jagged Little Pill. It was just so cool. Mm-hmm. So Faceful of Cake is a lyric in the song Double Parked, which is a really great, just great set of lyrics. And it's just sort of a funny, you know, thing, Faceful of Cake. So that was, it was between that and Gorilla for a long time. And Gorilla was kind of leading, right, for a long time.
And then
we were out for dinner one night, and we just asked everybody, like, at the bar and the restaurant, all the people we were with, and Faceful of Cake just, like, came out on top.
Because we were sort of, like, can we call it Faceful of Cake? That's so, like, I don't know, because we were like Gorilla, like seems like really punchy and commercial, and then I was, we were like, Aaron was like, what about Faceful of Cake? And I was like, I love that, but can we call it that? And I mentioned it to my wife. She was like, definitely, yes, that you should totally call it. I was like, really? And then, yeah, we went out to dinner that night and we asked everybody.
You know, it's funny, and it's, we've never taken ourselves seriously. We're definitely not. I mean, we're very serious about what we do, but we're not like, we're not walking around all like we're cool and we're, you know what I mean? So
we don't take
in the face. It's a joke kind of, you know? It's like, I think it
self-deprecating,
really, yeah.
Pocket full of kryptonite, face full of cake. That's an important point that Aaron made, which is like, we take what we do seriously. We take music seriously. We take the fact that people bought a ticket to our show and were like sober and ready to play and prepared. Incidentally, there's no, you know, computerized anything at our shows. There's no playback. There's no pitch correction. You come out and see a Spin Doctor show, you're gonna watch four people playing the music that you are hearing. So that's, you know, skinny legs and mistakes and all. But yeah, we take what we do seriously, but we don't take ourselves seriously. We're happy. I'm certainly happy to be like an object of ridicule and that goofy guy and the hat, you know, from that video long ago. I don't mind being like that funny guy from the Spin Doctors. But, you know, the truth is, like, that's fine and everything. But, like, you know, I can sing. He can play. Mm-hmm. You know, the other guys are, they're three of the best musicians of their era, with hands down. And face full of cake, man. Pocket full of kryptonite, face full of cake. And it did seem like kind of a quip sort of answer to pocket full of kryptonite, too.
Yeah, cool. Were you self-taught? Did you always know you could play?
I'm not self-taught. I mean, I've been interested in music since I was really young. Started playing classical piano. And when I was 9, I told my parents I wanted to take drum lessons. I got really lucky and they found this guy named Jack Iden that turned out to be an amazing drum teacher. And I've studied all through, you know, school and high school. I had private lessons and I went to a performing arts high school. And then I, you know, went to Berkeley for a year. And then I went to New School where I met these guys. So I consider myself like somewhat natural. Like, it's never been hard for me, but I put in a lot of work and a lot of study and I've had a lot of teaching. So yes, I'm not.
Tons of practice.
Yeah, I practice very.
He's a practicing.
They say you're supposed to put in 10,000 hours of anything before you're really ready for prime time. And I definitely, by the time I met these guys, I'd put in my 10,000.
Easily.
For sure.
Easily.
And there's plenty of great musicians that are completely self-taught. There's nothing wrong with that. Everybody has their own path, you know. Regardless of whether you're self-taught or you're studying or whatever it is, you need to put in the time. There's no way around that, for sure.
What about you, Chris?
I'm a mixture. I sang in choir in high school and I took like music theory, and I can't really read music, but I can decipher music. As a lyricist, my brother, who passed away last year, he was something of a genius, and he was sort of like a literature professor for me, and I'm dyslexic, so it's really hard for me to read. But really the upshoot of me being dyslexic is it's like just as hard for me to read like Romeo and Juliet as it is for me to read like a Michael Crichton Beach novel. So I've just always gravitated towards this kind of like heavy literature. So my brother kind of guided me through a lot of literature. My brother is like also very, very brilliant, and just, he's a mathematician, but he knew a lot of literature. And he would just be like, okay, now you need to read, you know, Thomas Pynchon, Gravity's Rainbow. Now you need to read like James Joyce, Portrait of the Artist of a Young Man. He would just like get me to read stuff, and he'd be like, Yeats, you need to read Yeats, and I want you to memorize Who Goes with Fergus. Like, he'd just like make me do all this stuff. So I think I'm kind of unusual for a rock and roll lyricist. I didn't go to school for literature, but I think my brother was even better, because I could go to him and ask him questions about stuff. And my brother wasn't the kind of guy who would just regurgitate stuff. He would give you this fully synthesized and educated take on whatever it was you were asking him about. So I kind of got lucky. It was like, you know, my brother's a genius autodidact and self-taught, you know, genius. And I was, you know, like the dyslexic, you know, big brother who would be like just reading everything that he told me to read. So, you know, I'm sort of a mixture of self-taught and highly trained.
Cool. That's so cool. I'm so sorry about your brother.
Yeah, me too. It was sudden and sad.
New bassist, how is that going?
Yeah, we have a new bassist, Jack Daly, who's amazing. You know, I've known Jack for a long time. And before he joined us, you know, I'd played with him in a lot of other different musical situations. So it was a real easy fit. You know, Chris knew him as well. They at least used to live in the Red Square apartment building together. Jack's played with a ton of people. He played in Lenny Kravitz's band for a long time, for like 15 years from like the 90s. You know, he's a member of Little Steven's band. He even filled in on Saturday Night Live with Bruce Springsteen when their bass player couldn't make it during COVID. So he has a really long discography, and he's a super cool guy. And you know, it's hard, I mean, to change members, it can go either way, you know, because we've always been a band where everybody, you know, had a real big part of the sound. You know, Mark, our original bass player, is a great bass player and huge contributor to our sound. So it's hard to replace that. And Jack came in and, you know, we told him, I mean, like, just do your thing. It's not about trying to sound like, you know, you got your own sound. And he's great at sort of respecting the parts that are important to a song, but making them his own. And he's been great. And it's cool that we were able to record a record with him so quickly and have new songs that he was part of to take out on the road. It just made it feel, you know, really authentic from the get-go. So Jack's great. We're really lucky to have him.
He and I lived in a kind of legendary apartment building called Red Square in Alphabet City in the 90s. And he was in Lenny Kravitz's band and I was, you know, the guy from the Spin Doctors. We would see each other in the elevator in the morning, and we were like chatting kind of friends, you know. And he would be in the elevator and he'd be wearing like, you know, like a bone breastplate sort of Native American thing, and like this like tank top thing with like lacing on it, and then and like these leather pants that went up the side, and these like, you know, cowboy boots with long and like turquoise everywhere. And just like put together, you know, and just like, you know, just like a rail. And I'd have just like woken up and done like 9 bong hits, and it'd be like, you know, 9 in the morning, I'd be like super stoned, and I don't do anything anymore, but, you know, and I'd be like, there'd be like, you know, ink spots from writing with fountain pen on my fingers, and maybe an ink spot on my nose, and I was wearing torn up jeans and like an old t-shirt. And we'd just be like looking at each other like across the elevator. And I was like, I always thought like, this guy is so cool. And we would like chat and talk, and we were definitely like really friendly. And when he got back in the band, I told him that story, and he was like, yeah, man, I was looking at you going like, who is this guy? He's so cool as well. At one point I'd just been like, you know, if somebody in the band, the original lineup, gets like abducted by aliens, then I'm like out. And we'll call it a day. It should just be the original guys or nothing at all. So when we started to make this change, I was sort of like, what are we going to do? And Aaron was just like, hey, let's just finish out the summer with Jack and see how you feel about it. Second, like, we stood on stage together at Soundcheck, all of those great memories came flooding back, and then we just played like Soundcheck, and by the end of Soundcheck I was like, this guy is the greatest. So we, you know, we're really lucky. As Aaron said, it doesn't always work out when you, especially with a quartet and you're changing somebody, but Jack is just, we're really lucky to have him. I mean, the guy's a huge rock star, the people that he's played with and stuff like that. And also, we just love him. He's such a great guy.
That's so great. What a funny story. Oh, I love it. I love it. Who'd you like better when she had a big butt? Or he had a big butt? Oh,
they had a big butt?
Everybody.
Yeah, everybody. Yeah. Oh, you know, we're like just a body positive, you know, pro women, pro underdog band, you know. That actually was about somebody that I had known, but it's sort of a combination. You know, we also have another song called Big Fat Funky Booty. It's just like, butts are funny, you know. Butts, you just put a butt in a song and you just like, you know, if you play your cards right, you're going to have a great song. But like,
it's an example of the silly, very silly, stupid side of the band, you know.
We're
like, you know, like we were saying before, I mean, we have all these serious songs, and we're not afraid to have some just ridiculous songs, which we do.
Yeah.
And it's fun, right?
It is fun.
Yeah. I don't know who that song's about, though.
Well, I'll tell you later.
Yeah, tell me later.
I'll tell you later.
I don't know.
I'll tell you later. But mostly it's more than that. It's I was just sitting around one day and like that idea, like, I liked you better when your butt was big. Just like, part of songwriting is like, people will say to me like, oh, that'd make a great song, you should write that. And I'll say, you should write that because it's not a good idea for a song, you know? It's taken me a lifetime to sort of like have an instinct of like what, if you go through my notebooks, you can see like my early stuff, you can see me like kind of tracing down a song idea and you're like, that could have worked out, but I can see why like that was abandoned. But now I'm like, you know, at this point in my career, like one of the things, you know, you get really good at is like knowing when you have, you go down to Nashville and you like go into a songwriting session and you sit down with these seasoned writers and you just sit there and you just like chat. And eventually you can feel the conversation like moving towards a song idea. And eventually, you know, these great Nashville writers, they'll be like, oh, there's a song in that. And that's the idea, like there's a song in that. So I was sitting on the couch and I was like, I liked you better when your butt was big. I was like, and I just wrote that lyric in like 15 minutes, you know. I just thought that was such a funny proposition.
So is there a book somewhere with all your old gems that you haven't done anything with?
I have like three shelves, you know, that are full of like notebooks that I've filled. And I now dictate a lot of stuff into my phone. I have like a lot of phone notes. So I have to put like keywords in there so I can like anything I think would make a good lyric or a good Spin Doctors lyric, I'll put like lyrics and Spin Doctors in. So I can just like put Spin Doctors in, a bunch of like things will come up.
That's so cool. Good. What do you guys like to do when you're not working?
Aaron's a fantastic cook.
I enjoy cooking, yeah.
Your food looks good too.
Yeah, I have aesthetically, like, you know, it's got to taste good. Most importantly, but I love the whole thing. I like if I have a day off, like going to the store, going to, you know, seeing what looks good that day, and you know, putting in a meal together, going home, prepping it, cooking it, shaking up a nice martini, sending these guys a picture of
my yeah. We love it. We
beautiful
love
meal.
We all take pictures of our dinners, and like, you know, I'm like, that looks tasty. You know, mine's like, yum. And like, you know, Eric is like, yeah, that looks yummy. And Aaron's just like, oh, well, I want to go to that restaurant, you know. Five stars.
And you guys are New York icons. What do you love about New York? What do you do in New York? What are your favorite things?
Oh, man, New York's the best. I mean, we've been living here since the band formed, you know.
Yeah.
And most people, you know, it's a tough city to stay in. I mean, you know, a lot of people, most people come in for a while and move out. And that's all good. And, you know, Eric moved back to Toronto. Jack lives down in Asbury Park. Me and Chris, we've just stayed here. I just love it. I mean, it's like, you know, we've traveled all over the world. There's some amazing cities. But I think New York's just my favorite. You know,
Me too.
Love the people here are so great. You know, there's just so much to do. Great food town. Beautiful architecture, you know, just the vibe. And for a musician, it's really one of the best places to be. I mean, I love to play music with people around the city and do stuff. And, you know, I mean, I moved here basically because I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to have a career in music, but I also wanted to be around the best musicians in the world because I figured that was going to make me better, you know. And I still feel that to this day, you know, it's like, it keeps you, you can't just sort of rest on your laurels in a town like New York.
Yeah.
You got to stay sharp because there's all our friends our age are great. And then there's all these young people that are just incredible. And then there's the people generation ahead of us, you know. So it's like we're sort of right in the middle now. It's kind of a really cool, it's kind of an inspiring time because, you know, I can get inspiration from all these great young, you know, musicians. Of course, all the older ones that are still around and then all our people our own age. So. That's why I came here. That's really what keeps me here, to be honest.
There's also, you know, theater here too. My wife's a musical theater actress, Lindsay Nicole Chambers, and she's like a comedic genius, you know, as well as being here for my music. It's like my wife as a theater actress. Just love theater. If you're watching this from out of town, you got to come to New York and see a show. If you come to New York, people always like, oh, I'm going to New York. I'm like, you can go see a show? And usually they are, but if they're not, I'm like, you gotta go and see a show. It's like one of those things that, you know, it's like going to Orlando and not going to Disney World, you know?
Yeah.
I recently, when I was a kid, my grandfather taught me about film photography. And so last year, when I was feeling, you know, really sad about losing my brother, I was at a flea market. That's another great thing in New York. You get these great flea markets. And I saw a camera on a table and I bought the camera. And so I got back into film photography and I've been taking classes down at the International Center of Photography and learning how to develop negatives and make prints and stuff like that. So New York has so much personality. When I was a kid, like middle school and high school, I lived in Princeton, New Jersey, where the Blues Traveler are from, and John Lithgow and some other like really famous, cool, B.B. Newworth went to the same middle school as me. And there was like this abandoned like observation tower way out in these like cornfields. We used to drive like a half an hour to get to this observation tower, which had like all these like signs, like stay off of it. It was like falling apart, and we were like climb, you know, 150 feet up this thing. We could have like fallen down and like killed ourselves. And we would sit up there and we would like, you know, smoke cigarettes, and you could see New York City like way off in the distance. It was like, you know, 50 miles away or something like that. And on a clear day, you could see New York, and we would like look at New York from this observation tower. It was like the size of your thumbnail. Like it looked like Oz, like off in the distance. And we would just sit there and be like, you know, someday we're gonna like live there and like be cool guys, like whatever we're gonna do, make some music. And
you did it.
Yep.
What does music do for people?
Music is a service and a science and an art. It's the mother of poetry and the daughter of life itself. It's absolutely primeval. There's not a single culture on earth that doesn't have some form of music. It definitely appears that as, you know, a species, as an animal, we are built for not just listening to music, but making music. I think, you know, up until the 20th century and the advent of recording, if you wanted to hear music, you had to make it, or someone in the room with you had to make that music. So if you read like Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, right, which was written in the 1300s, it's all, you know, these different character descriptions. And each person that he talks, most of the characters he talks about what voice they sang, like whether they're like an alto or a tenor or a soprano or a bass, and what instrument they play. Up until the 20th century, everybody played an instrument. You know, it sort of turned into this thing where like musicians were these like supremely talented. And you always had a cast of musicians that were on another level, you know. But for the most part, most people could like bang out. If you went to somebody's house and after dinner, you know, there's like nothing to do. And if they'd be like, sing us a song. You know, and if you couldn't sing a song, you wouldn't get invited back. You're like, you came over here, you couldn't like even sing a song or play, you know, or play something. So, you know, I feel really lucky that we get to do this for a living, because you just look out at the crowd when you're playing, and it is connecting with people on so many different levels. People who just don't know anything about your music are just responding to it on a fundamentally human level. And then you've got people who are there to like hear specific songs, and you're like evoking these memories for them. And you see, you know, go on YouTube and you can see like they take like catatonic, you know, elderly people who are deep in these like fugue kind of states, and they put headphones on from music from when they were young, and they just like come alive again. So there's a very real like connection that people have on a physical soul kind of level. And then, you know, in conclusion too, like we look out every night, one of the most gratifying things about being in this band these days is like you look out and the whole like front of the whole front row is like little kids, like 7-year-olds to like 20-year-olds, and they just got their like, you know, little chins on the barrier, and they're like kind of mesmerized by what we're doing. I think that goes back to the fact that, you know, there's nothing automated about what we're doing. It's completely, you know, that's sort of a spectacle now, watching people, you know, actually just perform music in a prodigious, prolific kind of way. And I think we need music more than ever, because it brings people together.
God, and like some of those old songs, they're like iconic. Of course the little kids are gonna know. It's on like all the jams on those guitars that are that they're still selling.
Yeah. It's fun watching, you know, like young people, and they're sort of like there with their parents, and it's sort of like that thing happens where they're like, oh well, you know, dad loves his band and mom loves his band, here we are seeing it, and they're sort of like, oh wow, you know, and before we ever play the hit, and then we play the hit, and then they go, they turn, you know, to their parents and like connect, you know, this is the song we play in the car, you know, and it's a beautiful way to
like it when you see like sometimes you'll see like the cool young kid that doesn't want to like us, you know, they're like sitting there like, man. But then like halfway through the show they're like, got him, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It is fun though, like to see all the different ages of people that come out to see this the band now, you know, and that's very cool.
We somehow struck a very universal thing. Two Princes and Little Miss Can't Be Wrong. And the album, Pocket Full of Kryptonite, again and again I've heard people say, you know, back in the 90s, like when I was a kid, like that, I didn't want to listen to like Neil Sedaka and my parents' stuff, and my parents didn't want to listen to like the grunge stuff that I was into, and nothing against either of those things, you know, perfectly both. We love grunge and we love, you know, all those guys. But, you know, talking about two different generations, and they'd be like, but we could put the Spin Doctors on. That was like the tape that we could listen to in the car, and everybody, like our parents and us, like we all like agreed, like that's what we wanted to listen to. And I honestly, like, I'm not really sure how we did that. Probably the drumming. Probably has a lot to do with the fantastic drumming. Somehow we have this kind of like ageless, timeless sort of appeal for people, and that's, you know, just really, we got lucky there, I think.
And I think the music lives on. You know, if you look at the kind of songs that seem to live on and stand the test of time, it's stuff that's not overly produced or overly like sonically to a certain generation. Like certain things just, you can tell like this is from that. I mean, obviously people hear us and it takes them back to the 90s, but it's just like the music is just sort of organic rock and roll.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and we got lucky and recorded like really good versions of those songs, and they still sound great on the radio, you know.
There's no gimmicks.
Yeah, and you know, so we didn't really expect that, to be honest. Even, you know, even when you have a big hit, you don't expect that, but you really don't expect it to sort of have the lasting power that these songs have had. And I think it's just because it's just good organic music. I mean, you know, it's why stuff like the Stones or Zeppelin or Creedence Clearwater, you know, just sort of classic songs still sound really good because there's no gimmick to them at all. You know, that's the music I think that really will last. So we feel, you know, super lucky that our stuff has continued to do that.
Yeah, when you go with a gimmick, you know, and you're trying like latch onto something that's popular in that moment. When that moment passes, that motif locks what you've done in that moment. So, and you know, there's a lot of great music, but like if you listen to stuff, a lot of stuff from the 80s, you know, it's got like a certain kind of reverb and a certain kind of synth, and all this stuff that was cool right then, but like you're sort of, you know, the second you hear it, you're like in this time. And you listen to these great Rolling Stones records, there's no, you know, gimmicky thing. It's just the sound of these great players, yeah, playing these great instruments.
That's a good way to look at it. Yeah, it's so true. And I wouldn't think your stuff was poppy. It wasn't poppy. It was like just bluesy rock and roll.
Yeah. I mean, we certainly weren't trying to have a hit record. I mean, we honestly, like, I can tell you 100% that was not on our mind. Like, we really just, when we went to make that first record, we really wanted to make a great record. I mean, that was really the only thing that was important to us. Nobody was thinking about like that we were going to have like this big hit. It wasn't until later that became even a possibility. And only after the record company told us to get off the road and go home and make another record because there were no hits on the record. And at that point, you know, we had been on the road for about a year and a half, and we'd seen like some of these songs become real popular within our fan base, you know. And I remember being in this meeting. We were all sitting around with all the heads of Epic Records, the whole band, our management. And we were just like, why don't you try like a song like maybe Two Princes or Jimmy Olsen or Little Miss? They seem to really, you know, you come to our show, people are singing along, you know. Nah, you guys need to come home, make a new record, get off the road. And so we sat outside of Sony Music just down the street over there, and our manager was like, you know, I'm telling you guys, something's gonna happen. You know, let's just go back on the road. I've seen this before. We're feeling it. We're feeling a buzz. And we did that. And like a few months later, a station up in Vermont, WEQX, Jim McGuinn was the DJ there, started playing Little Miss. It went to number one. He wrote a letter to the president of Epic, Richard Griffiths, and that lit the fire, and then the thing blew up. So then we knew, okay, maybe we're gonna have some hits, but we were not thinking about that at all in the process of making that record.
Quite the opposite. I mean, the reaction was quite the opposite. We put Two Princes out. Now it seems like this foregone kind of thing, but we put Two Princes out, and everybody at radio and some people at the label were just like, what is this supposed to be? You know, they're like, it's not rock and roll. It's not like R&B. It's like nothing. It's just like this thing in like the middle of like, you know, limbo, because, you know, it didn't really fit into a category. But, you know, those are the kinds of things that if they do get a chance, those are the things that really kind of take off, because they're sort of, you know, they've got an originality to them, as original as anything can ever
And it was
be.
Different, you know, you got to remember, like, this was right when grunge was really rocking. You know, like, our record came out a week before Nirvana's Nevermind came out. And then, of course, Nirvana record blew up. And it really helped us a lot because it opened the door. All of a sudden, rock was back on the radio. But it was more bands like Pearl Jam and Nirvana and that heavier stuff. But it opened up that lane for us, and when they finally, you know, decided to put some money behind us and go for real radio, it stood out because it was different from what was happening. It was still rock, but it was different. You know, we had our own sound, you know. So yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing, you know, really.
Grunge was in a genre that was in the industry called alternative, and it was all like heavy and dark and you know, some of the coolest music of the era for sure, but we were like kind of like happy and having a good time, and so we called ourselves like the alternative to alternative.
That's right, I forgot about that.
That's great.
But just to address that a little bit, to go a little deeper on that, Aaron very cleverly, when we were putting our repertoire together early on, you know, he had this very musical way of making sure that we had this kind of varied repertoire. So Aaron was like, we need songs with different tempos, different rhythms, and different like tonal landscapes so that our songs don't all sound the same. It's a very musical way of approaching it. You know, it's one thing to be like, we need like different kinds of songs, but to approach it like that is extremely musical, because then you're like, cool, we'll do some stuff in some different time signatures, we'll do some stuff, you know, slower stuff, faster stuff, and minor stuff and major stuff, not to get too technical. And then as the lyricist, you know, I added on to that, like, cool, yeah, and we need to have like these different emotional kind of landscapes as well. So we've got songs that our two most popular songs sort of have a happy feel, but, you know, Little Miss Can't Be Wrong is a very angry song, you know, and it's not about an ex of mine, it's actually about my dad's ex-wife who was particularly cruel and horrible to my brother and I. That's a whole other, my brother and I grew up in a very difficult, my dad's a wonderful guy, and he was as sort of traumatized by the whole situation as we were, but we had like a malignant narcissist, you know, that we were dealing with. And that's what Little Miss Can't Be Wrong is about. So if you delve into those lyrics, it's kind of tongue in cheek, but it's also kind of an angry song. And Two Princes is like a happy song with sad lyrics, really about a guy who is, you know, not really, you know, unrequited, dealing with like unrequited love. But then you go deeper into it, we've got Still a Gorilla on the new record, but on the first record we've got songs like Refrigerator Car, Shinbone Alley, that are also like really kind of heavy songs. We've got stuff that's as heavy as any of the grunge stuff, but we were also, the stuff that really caught on was sort of our happier, more upbeat stuff. But I do think if I was gonna compare us to these grunge bands, I would say that, you know, we sort of have a broader sense of like mood in the band, because we don't just have happy songs, we have angry and sad and different kinds of emotional, you know, we cover all the emotions, happy, sad, etc.
That's great. Any other favorites besides Gorilla on the new that we want to touch on?
Boombox.
Yeah, they're all
Boombox is a scream. I like The Buddha on the Lawn is kind of a funny, odd song. We have this thing, and I think one of the things that characterizes Spin Doctor songs is we have these songs that are like, why wouldn't anybody write a song about that? But you love it, you know? And like, Two Princes is such a weird song. If one, two princes kneel before you, princes who adore you. Like, I actually like wrote those two lines when I was 19. I wrote the song when I was 19. I got to those two lines, I was like, this is stupid. And I almost stopped writing the song. And I was just like, nah, just like, you know, just finish the song and see what happens. And half an hour later, I had ensured that I would never have to have a real job again. I didn't know that at the time. But The Boot on the Lawn is a song about like in the 70s. And there's like a dad who's like obsessed with lawn ornaments, you know. But it's just like my funny kind of take on a situation like that. I Liked You Better When Your Butt Was Big.
That's a funny one.
Rock and Roll Heaven, I think, is kind of a cool song. It's, you know, a vision of a rock and roll afterlife. And if you listen to the lyrics, there's some, like, it's a really kind of a funny comment on, you know, what's the difficulties of being a musician. And of course, in this vision of a rock and roll heaven, all these problems are solved. But, you know, it's like there's breakfast all day in every town and every the seat in the van goes down, and you know, the promoter's got a pizza and all your bread, and every Zeppelin is made of lead, and you know, it's just like it, you know, it goes through all these things that musicians sort of deal with on a day-to-day basis. But the guitar strings all change themselves, and I got lucky with that one.
It's a good one.
Your brother'd be proud.
Yeah, I think of him when we play it.
Awesome. What's next for you guys? Any musicians that you particularly like of today?
I mean, there's so many. It's hard to even keep track. You know, it's like, that's the problem. There's such a barrage of like information. You know, without like naming names. I mean, I'm very optimistic about the future of music. I think, you know, I see and hear so many incredible young musicians, and when I do sort of search around, there's tons of great bands and artists out there making really creative stuff and playing instruments as well. I mean, there's obviously a lot of stuff that's, you know, computer based, and that's cool too. I mean, I just think like we're at this point in music where, you know, modern sort of music, rock and roll, whatever you want to call it, jazz, it's, as time goes on, there's just so much more to sort of fuse together now. So a lot of the stuff I hear, the concepts of these young musicians and writers is just, you know, stuff that we would never think of, you know, and it's, I find it really inspiring. So I'm very, very optimistic about the future of music. I'm not as optimistic about how the business aspect of it, you know, it was really hard it's always been hard, and it was really hard when we first started, but there was sort of this formula for a band back then, as hard as it was, you know, if you had it, got a band together, wrote some good songs, you know, and had a really good, unique sound. That's hard to achieve right there, but do that. Go out and play a bunch of gigs. Get a following in your local's town. Get a record deal. Get on the radio. Get on MTV. Boom. I mean, really, really hard.
It's easy.
Really hard to do.
Piece of cake.
Really hard to do, but it sounds like I see so many artists in New York that if that formula was still around, you had a real chance back then, you know, but it's just different now. And I think with all the social media, I think a lot of people feel like they have to not only be a great musician or writer, but they have to be this social media personality. And it's whatever, you know, I'm not judging it, but for me, if I was gonna give any advice to like a young musician or a young band or a young artist, whatever, I would say, just like what we've said before, you know, find your own niche. Don't try to copy anybody else. We've already got all that. And bring it to the people, you know, because I do think that ultimately for getting music and making a living, you have to go out. I think it's a mistake to think that you're going to be able to do it all from home on your phone. Not to say that some people haven't, and that's totally valid. But I think, you know, go out there and play for people. You're going to be better anyway as an artist if you're out there getting reaction from a crowd. But I'm super optimistic about the state of music. I think it's great.
Who does that song, Pink Pony Club?
I'm not sure.
I love her. I, like, honest to God, I don't listen to a ton of music. If you look at it this way, like, a lot of the time that most people spend listening to music, like, we spend, Aaron listens to a lot of music, but a lot of time, you know, that most people spend listening to music, I spend making music. So when I'm not making music, a lot of times I'd rather like read a book or, you know, fool around with a camera, you know, like just play some chess, or, you know, like I just like to take a little break. One of the things that Eric Shankman, our guitar player, early on, by the time I met Eric, he was 25 and I was 20. He'd been playing guitar since he was like 14 years old. And I was like, don't you like, you know, Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones and the Who? And he was like, I've been playing all those songs in bars since I was like 14 years old. He's like, I don't really listen to rock and roll anymore for like inspiration for rock and roll. I was like, what do you listen to? And he was like, Ornette Coleman and, you know, John Coltrane, like bebop, Charlie Parker. And I was like, that's so cool. Because if you're taking these ideas from somewhere else, you're bringing them back to rock and roll, you're gonna have like, you know, these kind of fresh ideas. And I took that and I started to try and just go to like an art museum and like look at a Titian painting, or, you know, look at a Mondrian, or look at some ancient Greek sculpture or something like that. And then try and bring, obviously I'm not gonna write a song about an ancient Greek sculpture, but, you know, to use those kinds of things to just like freshen your mind and then, you know, come back to what you're doing. So, you know, a lot of times I don't listen to a ton of music. But I like that Pink Pony Club song.
Well, this has been awesome.
Thank you for having us.
Great. Congratulations on the new record. So good.
Thank you.
So good. Thank you. I look forward to seeing your book that's coming out and having your wife here sometime.
Yeah.
Across the street.
Yeah, she's very funny and way cooler than I am. Everybody likes Lindsay. You like Lindsay more than me, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Everybody likes Lindsay more than me.
We'll have to play next time.
Sure.
All right, yeah. If you'll have us back, definitely. I didn't know we were supposed to play. I have guitars. I have 20 of them. I could have brought them all. Played them all at the same time.
Well, we'll be here.
To see more of this interview, visit our website, lifeminute.tv. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Life Minute TV.